Okay, today is the 26th of December, 17th day of the month of Tevet. This is the women's Chumash Shir. We're in the middle of Parshat Ki Teitzei, Dvarim Perikafei.
Thank you. Okay, Rabotai. We are at the beginning of chapter Perikafei of Sefer Dvarim. We started last week this incredibly difficult set of three psukim. We'll just briefly review and then try to build on it today. The Torah writes, chapter 25, Perakaf Hei Pasukal, Ki Yeriv Bein Anashim, should there be a quarrel amongst people, V'nikshu El HaMishpat, and you will bring the person to justice. And the judge will render a decision of the case. V'itzdiku et hatzadik, he will declare as innocent the righteous one. V'hirshu et harasha, and he will declare as guilty the guilty one. V'haya bin hakot harasha, if he will now go ahead and administer lashes unto the Rasha, v'hipilo ha-shofet, the shofet, the judge, shall ask him to bend over, v'hikahu lefanav, and he shall strike him, kidei rishato, in accordance with his terrible deed, b'mispar, a certain number. So we pointed out last week that the pasuk itself, without Torah Sheba Alpeh, is simply unintelligible. Because there is never a situation whereby two individuals have a quarrel and they wind up in court that Beit Din will ever administer lashes. The way disputes between two individuals are resolved is you pay compensation. That's what happens. If we should have a fight, I have a fight with you and I deck you, so you'll summon me to Beit Din. Beit Din will declare me the Rasha, you will be declared the Tzaddik, and I will have to pay compensation, damages, doctor bills, unemployment, pain, shame, but I will not have it lashes administered to me. So what are we talking about, lashes? So we pointed out that this particular case, according to the Gemara, is talking about a most specific situation where two witnesses came to Beit Din and reported about something. A second pair of witnesses came to Beit Din and claimed that the first pair of witnesses were Edim Zomimin. Edim Zomimin means that the second pair of witnesses claim you two witnesses could not have seen what you reportedly testified about. The halakha is that we believe the second pair of witnesses, and you are to do unto the witnesses that which they intended to do to the defendant. Ka'asher zamam la'asot la'achiv. We had this in Dvarim chapter 19. So if this was a murder case, two witnesses testified that Reuven killed Shimon, two other witnesses testified, you could not have testified that Reuven killed Shimon on Sunday in front of Renat at 1 o'clock, because you two witnesses were with us in Buffalo watching the Giants beat the Bills 38-21.
That's better than the other.
Right, better than the other week. And clinching a playoff spot. So under those circumstances, we believe the second pair of witnesses. And what did they want to do to the defendant? They wanted to execute him. So they get executed instead. However, there are a couple of cases which the halakha does not allow us to implement ka'asher zaman. For one reason or another, there are a couple of cases where when the Edim Zomimin make the first pair of witnesses into these Edim Zomimin, that we are not permitted to implement ka'asher zaman. One of them, I gave you the case, was where somebody testified that a Kohen had a relationship with a divorced woman and as a result of that union conceived a child. What happens to that child? He is a chalal, disgraced from the kahuna. So we can't make the edim chalalim because they're not kohanim necessarily. So here the rule is, in such a situation, whenever you cannot implement ka'asher zaman, you give malchus to the witnesses. So the Gemara now claims this is the case. Ki hiye ribin anashim. Should there be any type of case amongst two people, any type of a quarrel, v'nikshu el ha-mishpat, and they come to Beth Din, and one person brings a pair of witnesses, ushvatum, and they ruled in accordance with the plaintiff against the defendant. The defendant was considered guilty. Now you have to fill in some words. Two other witnesses came to Beth Din and said, no, you two witnesses were what? Were with us. So now what does Beth Din do? V'hitzdiku et ha-tzadik. We tell the defendant who was initially declared guilty, oh no, you're innocent now. V'hershiyu et ha-rasha. We now prosecute an individual who heretofore was innocent. Who was an innocent? The two witnesses. They accepted their testimony. Now that we know that they were false witnesses, they now become the Rasha'im. And it happened to have been a case where you could not have implemented Ka'asher Zaman. Therefore, what are you supposed to do? Administer lashes. So now the Torah, the story continues, as if all of this is in the text. Vahaya im bin hakota rasha. Now what happens if you were, Beth Din will now decide to strike the rasha. It really, in this case, now is the Rishaim, the two witnesses. How do they do so? Vehipilo hashofet. You make the person bend over. Vehikahu lifana. And you hit him literally in front of him. So Rashi will say, some of the shmites, some of the hitting is on his back, and some is on his front. Okay? You take this whip, and you hit him 39 times. Kidei rishato, in accordance with his transgression, bimisfar, with the number that has been assigned. What number has been assigned? Next pasuk. Arba'im yatenu, velo yosif. Strike him 40, don't add on to that. Ten yosif lahakoto aleila makaraba. If you're going to decide to give him more than 40, that might be too overpowering of a punishment. Your brother will either what? Be shamed, embarrassed, humiliated, or worse yet, what might happen to him if he might just suffer physical harm. Therefore, don't go overboard. Fine. Very nice. Yeah.
Why is lefanav not lifnei hashofet? That would be so reasonable.
Okay.
Why? What's the problem?
Okay. The problem is that the whole word lefanav is totally superfluous.
I think
could have said vihikahu, vihipilosho vihikahu. Obviously, it's in front of the judge. What? Where else are you going
to
do
it? Make sure they don't take him away somewhere else, so that the judge can supervise and monitor to see that the punishment isn't excessive.
That's correct. The judge must do that. We know that all administration of punishment is done in the presence of Beth Din.
How do we know that?
We know that elsewhere.
Why not here?
Okay, but this is an issue. But that's a given. That Beth Din must always administer the punishments. They don't actually have to do it, but they have to supervise. They don't have to actually push you off the cliff if you're chayav skila, but they have to make sure they're doing it right. So, in this case, yeah?
Why can't lefanav mean in front of the person who he wronged?
Right.
That's a good suggestion, but what are you going to do in a situation where, we're not talking about this particular case, you went ahead and ate non-kosher meat. Okay, we give you lashes. Why would it have to say lefanav in that phrase? I hear what you say. Interesting suggestions. Rashi will interpret this that it lefanav means as opposed to what? On his back. Some of the, now, and what's bothering Rashi is in effect like this. If you're telling the person to bend down, what would be logical, or where on the body would you be struck if you're asked to bend over like this? Your back or your front?
Back.
Your back. Because if you're going to strike somebody on the front, why are you bending over like this? So that's what's going to trouble Rashi. It says, Vehi pilo hashofet. You make them bend over. And then it says, Lefanav. So Rashi comes up. It's not Rashi, it's the Gemara. 2/3 of the whippings are on his back. That's 26. 1/3, 13, are on his front. So it's Vehi pilo. You make him bend over and you will administer some strikes. Now, also, Vehi kahu lefanav. Strike him on the front. Now for those 13 that gave him in the front, he's going to have to stand up. Otherwise, how are you going to hit him in the front if he's bent over like that? Humped over.
Okay.
So it's, yeah.
Just one other question about the previous question. The fact that she says Rasha twice, and not Risha in, even though by definition it has to be two people based on the information, is that just a struggle?
No, that's, in fact, many times the Torah uses the word aid, and it means aidin. Many times.
Okay.
Many times. We only take one. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Of course it's awkward. Of course. We'll see. Rashi will quote about it in a second. Okay. That's how Chassidut interprets it simply, in front of the judge. And what Rashi's bothered with is that it's obvious. Of course he's going to do it in front of the judge. So now let's take a look at some of the incredible halachot that the Gemara learns out from many words of this particular pasuk. I want to start with Kidei Rishato, the last part of the phrase. Betin shall administer the lashes, Kidei Rishato, in accordance with what? His wrongdoing, his evil. So what question would you ask? Say it sharper.
Where's the statute that tells you how many for each?
Okay. So that's why it's going to say in the next pasuk, don't think that there are, for eating non-kosher meat is 28. For eating it's always arba'im yaken.
Oh.
It's always 39, no matter what you did. So if that's the case, what is
the word today?
Correct. I am never going to imagine that Beit Din will strike you for something that you weren't guilty of. Right? Obviously, you're summoned to Beit Din because you did something wrong. And they are now going to administer lashes. Obviously, why are they administering lashes? Because you did something wrong. What else would there be a reason for Beit Din to administer lashes if not in accordance with that which you have done wrong? So the Gemara learns out an incredibly important principle. It's used thousands of times. It's called Kamlei B'Derabba Minei. And there's a little song that goes with it from downtown, you know. Kamlei B'Derabba Minei. Whoa, whoa, whoa. That's the way we sing it in class. Kamlei B'Derabba Minei. Which means, here is the case. I'm going to illustrate the case and then the principle. Okay? I am standing. I see somebody who I don't particularly like, and I plan on killing. I take out my bow and arrow, and I aim it directly at him. As the arrow is released, there is somebody hanging up her laundry in the backyard. And my arrow, on its way to what? To execute this person, which it accomplished, also rips a hole in this person's sheet. No, it didn't touch her. It reached my intended target, and the guy's El Dedo. Next, it also ripped this person's sheet. How many people are going to sue me in court?
Two.
The family of the deceased are going to sue. They want to get vengeance and justice, right? And this grandmother here, whose sheets were ripped when she was hanging up her laundry. The halakha is, I don't have to pay her a penny. Now tell me, how the Gemara comes to that conclusion from this phrase? Tell me how...
Well,
the damage is, intention is of no halakhic concern. If I cause you damage, when I didn't intend to do so, I held it. Accidents, it makes no difference. I could be sleeping, and my arm in the middle of the night can just, you know, move accidentally, and I'm in somebody's house, and I knock over the lamp, I'm chayef to pay for it. So tell me from the phrase... Yeah, obviously that's what we're focusing on.
The worst
Okay, but first you have to see how they learn it from the word. Mishum Risha Achat. Kedei Rishato. Only the one transgression. Somebody can be prosecuted only for one transgression. If he did it, it's one action caused two results. Now, the more severe. Kam lei v'derava minei means, whenever you have to now make a decision about which of two to implement, you take the more severe and you do not administer the less severe.
So obviously they didn't have criminal and civil law, you know, usually. There was no distinction between criminal liability and civil liability.
That's correct. It's all one court. So in this case, kidei rishato, only for his risha, that's one. Durash, you can never prosecute a person for one action if it has multiple consequences, multiple rishayot. Is it logical? Of course not. Why should this woman lose money on her sheep because I happen to be being executed for another murder?
What if somehow he killed her and he killed her?
So then, of course, he's only going to be killed once. But here the chiddush is that here, in this case, I could have expected that before they execute him, they go to his bank account and they say, pay up the debt and then we'll execute you. Or make his yorshim, the estate. The estate pay for it. We should be able to do that. But we can't. It's a halacha. And then, which of the two do you apply? One of the two, never two. That's one thing that we learn out from Kidei Rishato. This is number 58 on the 150 that you have to know in order to fool everybody. Come labor the rabbit. Downtown, that's what? Makes no difference. For any case which generates multiple.
So what happens if you cheat in the stock market and it caused a lot of people to lose money? What?
That's a good question. But there is only one.
So you cheat trading or whatever it is.
Okay. That's a good question. How do you
count in this court? There's one count that will count.
Right.
You can't charge them. You can't give a choice between second degree manslaughter and first degree homicide. That's one charge.
One, but even if it's two separate episodes, if one action led to two separate episodes, you can only be held to charge for one of them, in effect. I don't know. It's a good question. If one action caused, you know, multiple
trade and
okay, that's
who do you have to reimburse?
Okay, who do you have to reimburse? Okay, that's a good question. There it's one transgression. Stealing. So I can steal from several people. Okay, I have to see how it works through. Yeah.
In Halakha,
yeah.
Somebody killed the father of six children. So you kill the father of the six children. Is the person, the estate or anybody responsible for no monetary compensation?
None whatsoever.
Family?
None.
Whatever?
That's correct. That's point number one. Point number, yes.
What if
mom and he's going to be held accountable for debt. In that case, somebody planted a bomb and killed 100 people.
Yeah.
His act caused one transgression, murder, low-tier soccer. In this case, which I'm illustrating, it's two different offenses,
okay.
Not a multiple occasion of the same offense. It's two different offenses. One is murder, one is... You can have a situation where you could have one action or one leading to two different consequences of thievery and compensation. So you'll have lashes and money. So the Gemara says, always pay the money, don't give the lashes. That's the way they resolve it. Always pay the money, don't give the lashes. Can't do both. That's point number one. Point number two is a startling statement in the Gemara about lashes in general. The Gemara says, Makot bimkom mita omedet. Makot bimkom mita omedet. What do you think that means? What do you think that means? Makot, what? Lashes, what? So now tell me the scenario. What really should have happened when you violate X, Y, and Z? You theoretically should be executed by God for this transgression. But God is all merciful one, number one, and he recognizes that to impose a death penalty on so many of his statutes will lead for Benson to be in full-time business of executing people. And therefore, what they decided was, what God decided was, that for certain transgressions, I'm not going to execute. What am I going to instruct instead? Give lashes. But you should know that makot bimkom mita omedet. And I want to share with you the Chavetz Chaim's explanation of this. Chavetz Chaim's explanation, Shabbos, there is a death penalty. You get stoning. So for those which the Torah has stipulated, so then there is no exception. But for regular lashes, for the majority of negative transgressions, the penalty is lashes. Says the Torah, what you're supposed to really have done has been executed for any of these. But out of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's sense of understanding of being a realist in addition to an idealist, he legislated that I'm only going to let you off with this. And the Chavetz Chaim gives very simple examples to explain it. Okay? We've all rented apartments once upon a time ago. Right? Rent an apartment. So you get a lease from your landlord. Flush safe and lease. No washing machine and dryer in the apartment. No dogs in the apartment. Says this. Good. Now what happens if, after you read the lease and you sign it, 2 weeks later you call up Macy's or Sears and you get yourself a Maytag washing machine and dryer, and then the landlord finds out about it. What's going to happen to you? What is the landlord going to do? Either that, and if you don't listen, what's he going to do? He's going to evict you, very simply, get an eviction notice. Says the Chavetz Chaim. This world is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's apartment house. We're all tenants. We have a lease. It has 613 clauses. One of the 613 doesn't say you can't put a washing machine in a dryer. But it does say you can't eat tray for meat. So when you eat tray for meat, defying the landlord, what should happen? Eviction notice. Goodbye, Charlie, you're out of this world. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu understands that it would be a little too difficult to give so many eviction notices, and therefore he has decided to allow Malkut to replace the penalty of Nisan. But, says the Chavetz Chaim, Ekronit, fundamentally, a person deserves mita for any transgression that you violate. Why? Because the landlord has imposed certain stipulations. And if you don't comply with the landlord's stipulation, you get an eviction notice. It's simple as that. That's all. If you don't want to, abide by the landlord's thing, so then check out on your own. Goodbye, Charlie. That's all.
Does this one come from this puzzle?
No. Now, that this idea does not emerge from the puzzle. This second idea emerge is a statement in general, since this is the only parsha of the Torah that discusses the institution of Makot, therefore I wanted to let you know how the Gemara understands the application of Makot. That it really is in lieu of death. Yes.
Don't we have a principle somewhere that someone who, when you humiliate someone, it is almost as though you cause his death?
Correct. Hamal b'pnei chaver b'ravin.
Right. So, in this case, the person who received Makot is humiliated in public.
That has nothing to do with anything.
And
I am allowed to humiliate you from today till tomorrow.
I realize that.
Because I'm your teacher.
In that sense,
Beth Din is allowed to humiliate
death.
Anybody.
I understand that. But in that sense, it could take the place of death. In other words, that could be...
Interesting. Nice.
Of that.
Good. That's a nice interpretation.
Oh,
it's a nice interpretation. Okay. I hear what you're saying.
I have an idea similar to what you find in the Torah where it says that Eretz Yisrael sit you out because you behave in a certain way.
Yes.
Same idea.
Vataki ha'aret et yoshveha. Correct. Parshat Akrimot at the end. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Bet in.
They have a guy who works for them, who does nothing but schmeichels. They have guys who choke you to death when you're supposed to, they have guys who pour hot lead down. They advertise for paper. Who would like to work for them?
Execution.
Yes. Interesting. That's possible. That's a nice interpretation. It's a nice interpretation.
What?
That the Dayan himself doesn't have to do it. It's only in the presence of Beis Din, but they don't have to give the actual... That's an interesting interpretation. That's good.
How many fees are done a day?
What?
How many fees are done every day?
I can't tell you. I don't know. We don't have any evidence of statistical records of how many of these were done. I would imagine... See, if I were to look at the first temple day, Bayit Rishon, this Beis Din would never have stopped working. Because we know what type of a terrible generation it was. They worshipped, they were paganists. They worshipped pagan idolaters. So they should be executing, stoning people all day.
Unless they also bribe the judges and the judges.
That's also possible. That's correct.
Yeah.
So this, can you imagine today? Just imagine today. Okay? If we had Sanhedrin, a Bentley, this person would be non-stop Islam. They see just in Tinan alone. You know how many yet to be observant Jews there are? Who will say, I don't believe in this system. Oh, you went into McDonald's, let's go. Give them a warning, bring them to bed. You're driving on Shabbos, take them right to bed, Sunday's executed. I don't know how it would be. I don't know what would happen to Am Yisrael if there was a Sanhedrin instituted and we would actually administer Torah law.
But yet I think that in so many ways our society today is even less illegal with the punishment. And it's because for instance, if we have a situation like you said where the father of these children was killed and so you cite another person and that other person is Chayav Mita. The children would say, no, we don't want that guy's kids to suffer what we're suffering. We'll take the money. That's today's society,
I know. But Torah doesn't give you a choice. It's not up to the victim to determine how the punishment is going to be administered. Obviously, all of the Torah's punishments should be viewed as a deterrent. That's what it's designed for, to hopefully serve as a deterrent. In fact, the Gemara makes a comment that at one time, I forgot when, there were so many murder cases going on that they decided no longer to execute. So many people, because it wasn't accomplishing its objective.
Wow.
It wasn't serving as a deterrent. So I'm just going to kill people left and right?
What?
Wait a minute, they're not a deterrent?
At that time,
being killed is not a deterrent?
No.
How come today in states where there is capital punishment? Still people go ahead and murder. They don't care. That's all. They don't care. And nobody thinks you're going to get caught. Exactly. And it's much harder in our system to prosecute. There's no such thing as circumstantial evidence by us. No such thing.
Right. Was there ever a case where they
have to do the 39 lashes mask, but do they ever stop midstream?
I'll get to that in 1 second. I'll get to that in 1 second. Now, concerning the lashes itself. Now let's look at Pasuk Gimel. Arba'im yakenu. Lo yosif. You are never permitted to go above and beyond. Here it says 40. We will soon see it means 39. Now, if it says lo yosif, what do you have a right to infer from the fact that it says you can't add? Give less. How? There is a doctor every single day assigned to Beth Din who physically evaluates each person who has now been assigned makot and says, how many can this guy handle? If the Dayan says he can only handle 2, Beth Din only gives 2. If the Beth Din says he can handle 13, you give 13. There is a medical doctor who works in conjunction with the Beth Din to evaluate the medical condition of the guilty party to help determine whether or not he or she can tolerate 39 lashes.
They lash women too?
Of course. Why not? We believe in equality. We were the founders of equality. Right? Bat mitzvah? No. 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 Bat mitzvah no. 20 is only heavenly court. Down here, bar and bat mitzvah. Somebody, 12-year-old girl, gets 13-year-old boy, gets lashed. Now, let's take a look at Rashi. Take a look at Rashi on the word bimispar at the end of Pasuk Bet. And Rashi will now try to somehow read into the text that even though it says 40, it doesn't really mean 40. It means 39. Let's see how Rashi says. Rashi says, it says in the pasuk, "Kidei rishato bimispar." Next phrase, "Avarim yaken." What word is totally superfluous? The mispar. It could have said, "Vehiko lufanav kidei rishato." How much? Arba'im yakenu. Then I would ask, how many are you supposed to get? And you'll say, the number is 40. I mean, whatever it is, 40, 39. But you don't have to say bimispar in accordance with the number and then say 40. Obviously. So take a look at Rashi. Bimispar. Ve'eno nakud bamispar. The vowelization is not with a patach, bamispar, but bimispar. Lamed, this teaches us, Shehu Davuk, that the word bimispar, it can't stand alone. So it must mean what? It must be connected to something else. Correct. It's connected to the next word. We find the word bimispar tons of times in the Chumash. For example, in Bamidbar chapter 1, It says the phrase bimispar shemot 60,000 times. What does bimispar shemot mean? Do not count people what? 1, 2, 3. What do? You submit something, right? You submit a piece of paper, a number, whatever it is, but don't count. So it's bimispar shemot. Here too, bimispar can't stand alone, says Rashi. Lomar, to teach you, bimispar arba'im, something around the number 40, velo arba'im shleimim, but not really 40 complete. Ela, minyan shehu sokein umashlim la arba'im. A number which will get you eventually to what? To 40. So now we go to Sakha Mishrit, and we bring the count. What number will get you into what? Into 40? 39! Oh, 39 will bring you to this number. 39. So therefore, Vehain Arba'im chaser achat.
It's
the oldest kash in the book. Why do I need a whole word, an extra word to go like this and put no... Just say 39, end of discussion. So Ibn Ezra, not here, in Parshat Vayigash. In Parshat Vayigash, and in many other places, I'll give you the pasuk upon which he makes the comment. Bishivim nefesh yardu avotecha mitzrayma. What does that mean? With 70 people, our forefathers went down into Egypt. Good. You now do a count, and you see that there are only 66 names, because all of the children of Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, they're all mentioned in Parshat Vayigash. Binyamin, for example, had 10 children.
Yeah.
So there is a total of 66 people that are identified by name. So you ask, where did you get 70 from? So Rashi says, Yosef is in Mitzrayim, Binyamin and Menashe are born, and Yocheved was nolad ben ha'olot. Yocheved was born as they were entering into the walls of Egypt. Very nice little medrash, beautiful. Says Ibn Ezra, the Torah rounds off. That's all the Torah does. For example, says Ibn Ezra, please open up to Bamidbar chapter 1 for just a minute. He gives a striking example. Bamidbar chapter 1. It's one of the census opportunities of Am Yisrael. So Uwet Rosh B'nai Yisrael, and look at the number that is at each unit. There's a little pay. It says B'nai Ruvain, B'nai Shimon. Look at the number at each one of the tribes. There's just a number.
Around.
Of course. Not one of them ends in 247. Each one is, what, 39,500? 300. Says Ibn Ezra. The statistical probability that all 12 tribes should end off exactly in an even a number, rounded up to the nearest 100, is unlikely. Highly unlikely. Statistically impossible. Every single tribe. So he said, instead of telling us that this tribe at 47,292, they wrote 300. Very simple. So wherever the Torah has to give us a number, know that the Torah is imprecise. It rounds off to the nearest 10 or to the nearest 100. Therefore, Ibn Ezra says quite simply, it says Arba'im, because 39 is pretty close to 40. But he writes, and I quote, just to calm you down, for a second, one second. Where is Mr. Ibn Ezra? Yeah. He says, really, rat lo yosif al Arba'im. Really, the Torah says don't give more than 40. Lulei divrei Kabbalah, aside from our tradition of Parash Baal Peh, which says that it's not more than what?
39.
Vehu levado ha'emet. I have to acknowledge that's the truth, because that's what the Gemara said. From a simple Pshuta Shal Mikra, it doesn't seem to be, because this is not a round off of an exact, of a number of two. Here you're dealing with what? Schmeissing a person. You should be precise. Precisely, you should be precise. That's correct.
So,
but nonetheless, yeah?
So the number 39 doesn't come from this pasuk. The number 39 comes from, Masorah, and then...
Not according to Rashi.
Rashi
learned it out from the word bimispar. Okay. That's the funksia of bimispar.
Here he's actually thinking...
That's what the text is communicating to us. Is that... It would have been a lot easier to write Shloshim Vitesha as opposed to writing Bimisbar Arbaim, and then Ani Rashi, well, it doesn't say Bimisbar.
Also, you could have a Gezer that, you miscount by one, so they could, say
39
just in case.
Okay, that's also
possible. If you missed it, you would be going over.
Correct. There is a Gemara that talks about such a thing. A Dayan, who was supposed to give only 28, because the doctor said he can't have 20, and he gave him 29. What happens to that Dayan? He violates a law, if he causes damage, he's got to pay for it, because he has no right to do it.
Does he get
What?
Did he get
No, I ask you, how do you handle somebody who has to, who causes damage?
Right.
You pay for it. That's what you do. Yes.
The 39 pool was in the tradition of like saying catch for 11 months instead of 12. In other words, you
No.
No.
That's Kabbalistic. We don't say Kaddish for 12 months because in Kabbalistic terms, the Kaddish is done to cleanse, and we never want to make a public statement that my mother or father were the worst of the lot to get the maximum sentence.
Exactly. So you never want to say that this person who is Chayav Malko is so bad that he needs the whole...
So you write 40, only gets 39.
Because
that's a nice idea. Nobody's really that bad. Okay, but that's introducing Kabbalistic idea in the Torah text, and we know never to do that. That we should never do. There are so many examples, just a parenthetical remark, where Kabbalah runs against Halakha. Runs against Halakha. Somebody passed away in Israel. And the children were told by the Chevra Kadisha not to come to the cemetery.
In Yerushalayim.
In Yerushalayim. The boys were told not to come to the cemetery. Of course they're not fine. But even a Kohen is obligated to come. They were told not to come. And they gave this whole business, I know what the Kabbalah is all about. Yet it's black on white in Shulchan Aruch that the obligation to bury a parent lies squarely on the shoulders of the child. Black and white. He's chayav to be buried. Who else is obligated to bury? The halacha assigns that responsibility. So we tell a child not to fulfill his or her biblical obligation to defer some Kabbalistic idea.
Of what?
I'll tell you what it is. Okay? I'll tell you what it is. I once told you about this. That in certain Chevra Kadishas, they will dance around the deceased before they put the deceased and flip the coin backwards. That's correct. They make hakafot and they recite a pasuk at the end of Parshat Toldot, which reads, "Ulibnei hapilad shim natan matanot." To the children of the concubines, I am giving what? Gifts to buy them more. So the Kabbalah goes as follows. When a husband and a male ejaculates, there are thousands of sperm that potentially can become a child. One impregnated the egg and gave birth to this boy or to this girl. But all those other sperm who did not come to life are demons. And they come to haunt you at the cemetery when you come to bury your father or mother, and they are angry at the father. Why? How come I didn't get to come alive? Only you did. So they are there to damage you and to curse you. So in some circles, the way they get them off is they buy them off. You circle the deceased, and you flip coins behind you, and you say, here, demons, go ahead and we'll buy it. Just go away. Don't curse them. In other communities, they don't allow the children anywhere near this cavern because they're afraid of it. Ayin Hora. Depends on which cavern. That these demons are going to attack you. Demons are going to attack you. Now, sometimes these demons enter halakha. For example, you'll make a bar mitzvah, okay? You'll make a bar mitzvah, and you have lots of relatives you want to give. No. If you'll make a bar mitzvah, okay? We have a practice, it's quoted in Shulchan Aruch, you can never give a father and a son back-to-back aliyot. Never give a father and a son back-to-back aliyot. Okay? So here you have a situation, particularly with Kohanim, who have limited number of aliyot. So you have a grandfather's cut, you give him Kohen. Okay? Now you want to give the father, you'll make an extra aliyah, acharon, which can be a Kohen, but the son is going to get master. You can't give a father and son back-to-back aliyot. We don't give two brothers back-to-back aliyot. Why? because the demons, they see two family members one after the other, they get very annoyed, and they start attacking. Demons. Trust me, nothing's going to happen. It's two brothers. But the Gemara is worried about these demons. There are discussions in the Gemara of Amoraic sages who took demons to court. Rav Ashi was once traveling and he had his water bottle with him and a demon poked a hole into it and it leaked out. So Rav Ashi summoned the court. And the demons argue in his defense that you, Rav Ashi, came to a place you should have expected that you stepped on one of the demons. Because demons hang out near drain pipes. And Rav Ashi was walking to a shortcut near a drain pipe and he should have understood there are demons. So you stepped on me, I was a little annoyed, and I poked a hole in your thing. This whole discussion between Rav Ashi and the demon summoned in court by Rav Ashi. I don't understand what it means. Nobody understands what it means. But at times, the halacha has given recognition to it, despite the fact that we know there is absolutely nothing halachic. It's pure ayin hara, this superstition. That's what it is. It's superstition. What? Shade.
Shaded.
They're all different kinds of things.
Which
communities
actually still do
this? With the Hebrew in Yerushalayim, many do. When I was in Israel, my grandfather passed away many years ago, they were doing this, and I was horrified that they were doing this little dance, throwing the coins, because my grandfather didn't believe it. He didn't believe in the shade, and they didn't believe it. And they were doing it. It was terrible.
Is it mostly in Israel?
Yeah, I've never seen it here. Here, the Chevra Kadishas don't have that kind of clout. Chevras perform a service. They don't run. They run it. They're in charge. They are in charge. That's the difference. Yeah. Okay, there are many who have questioned. The Rambam writes that all these shadim is a bunch of bulons, a bunch of nonsense. Don't believe in it at all.
Now,
Rashi points out something else, which is extremely significant. Please look at Pasuk Gimel and tell me what does Rashi, and this is Rashi is the name of Gemara, a very important statement, because it counters an intuition or a statement that other people might make. What does Rashi say we learn out from the word lo yosif? Rashi's claim is, I don't need that it shouldn't add. If the Torah says 40, I know it can't be 41. How do I know it can't be 41? Because it says 40. If I were allowed to give 41, it would say, why write lo yosif? Says Rashi. What does Rashi say? Tells the teachers halacha. What is the halacha which Rashi says?
Azhara
lemake et chavero. This phrase is a general prohibition against what? Any person striking another human being. Because I have spoken 50 times, how does the parsha deal with striking people? From what vantage point does the Torah deal with it up until now? And doing what?
A punishment.
What? Compensation. That's all the Torah discusses. If I destroy your property, you do this. If I hurt you, I do this. I'm a very wealthy person, and I can't stand you. I will go over to you directly, knowing full well that I'm going to pay damage. I'm going to punch you in the mouth. Hopefully I'll break your jaw. And I will take out my checkbook right away. Whatever the damages are, will I have been guilty of anything? If you only have Parshat Mishpatim, the conclusion you reach is, I violated absolutely nothing. Why? Because no place until this point does it ever say, you're not allowed to strike another human being. It never says it. Yes, I know Moshe Rabbeinu told the Jew, Lama take et reyecha. But that's a narrative story, and we don't learn out halachic principles from the narrative story of Moshe in Egypt, who was prior to Sinai. He just says, why are you hitting him? So in order for me to create what is called an act of inappropriate, it's wrong, you're not allowed to do it, the Torah writes, lo yosef. In other words, striking a person when you're not allowed to is not prohibited. It's not only, so there can be two ways when you're not allowed to. Right now, I decide to hit somebody, I'm not allowed to. And in a bet din where they're allowed to give 39 and they decide to give 41, that's also you're not allowed to. This now serves as the law for hitting somebody. Because had there not been a law, I would have come to the erroneous conclusion that the Torah only deals with damages between people from a monetary compensation point of view. And I will say, fine, I'd love to deck you, I'll pay for it in full. And there's nothing off my back. So it's a lot. You're not allowed to do stuff. In fact, the Ramban, it uses this idea to inject a lesson about striking people. The Ramban believes that's why the Torah uses the phrase constantly, ayin tachat ayin, yad tachat yad, chain tachat chain, regel tachat regel, despite the fact that we don't believe it. Because if I break your arm, what am I supposed to do? Besen doesn't break my arm. You pay. Says the Rambam. Very nice. I guess I'm a wealthy man. I don't mind breaking somebody's arm. I'll just pay for it. Says the Rambam, by right, what do you really deserve? Have your arm broken. That's what you really deserve. But it's impossible for Beit Din to mete out exact punishment. Because this guy, when he broke his arm, he didn't have it, wasn't as painful. When you'll break this guy's arm, it'll be much more painful. So you can't exactly have it measured, tack for tack. So therefore, we don't do it. But in theory, says the Ramban, that's what you should get. Because so many people only understand that damaging another person is only a responsibility to pay. That's all you think. And it encourages people to be aggressive, to be wild, and be willing to accept the consequences. So the Torah wants to put a damper on that line of thinking. It does it in two ways. To remind you that really, Al Pi Din, you should be suffering a broken leg. And according to Rashi and the Halakha, it now becomes an offense between you and God.
That's amazing.
Because what is the best insight? You're not allowed to end. So now he extrapolates. Anytime you're not allowed to hit somebody, you violate this law. So in Benson's case, when will you violate it? After you went past number 39. In your case, if you'll hit somebody, when did you go? Well, how many were you allowed to give? Zero. So when you hit one, you violated Lo Yosef.
So is that only the main zero? The lav is the main part?
Correct.
And the shogeg is just
that
you pay compensation?
Correct. That's the main zero. You violate the lav and you pay. The shogeg, it's just compensation. That's correct.
And the punishment for the lav is what it's just between you and God in terms of...
In theory, it should be lashes.
But it's not. It's
because you pay. Because that comes back to the first thing I said.
Right.
Whenever there are two consequences, you only do one. Only do one. Yeah.
What about a teacher striking a child?
Okay. It's a very good question. The answer is, a teacher is allowed to strike a student for disciplinary reasons.
For teaching?
Yeah, for teaching. Yeah.
No, because the child doesn't know the answer that you said.
Okay, that's, yes, because the teacher assumed that the kid wasn't listening and this, that's why he doesn't know the answer. A teacher is allowed to hit a student.
Is that initial?
Black on white.
And that's,
he can humiliate him, black on white. And if he does even result in the child's death, the teacher is not held accountable. He does, not only does he not get executed, what happens when you kill somebody b'shogeg?
You have to go to Aray Miklat.
A Rebbe who hits or kills a student b'shogeg does not go to Aray Miklat. He's exempt. He was doing his job. Obviously, I don't tell teachers to do that. But, yes. Okay, we'll stop here and continue next time.